Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and for 30 years, I have been both the CEO of Technology Partners and the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. I'm delighted to have Will Parker Anderson on the show today. Will is a senior editor at Penguin Random House Christian. Well, Will Parker Anderson, welcome to the Something Extra podcast. I'm so delighted that we can make this work today.
Yeah, Lisa, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So you and I always love to tell our listeners how we connect, and you and I connected via LinkedIn. I think you
is
reached,
that right?
Yes, via LinkedIn. You had reached out, or somebody had reached out on your behalf, and when I looked into your background, I'm like, yeah, you are the perfect guest for the Something Extra podcast and what we are trying to do with the show. So I'm just so excited. By the way, what a powerful platform, right? Shout out to LinkedIn.
Yeah, who knew LinkedIn could lead to great conversations like this? I love it. I have connected with a number of folks on there, and yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Well, I know that our conversation today is really going to help our listeners because you got a lot of knowledge around communication and storytelling, Will, and I can't wait to really jump into that. But I know that you grew up in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And really growing up in Arizona has a lot to do with what you're doing today. So I would love for you to tell me about the heat of Arizona and how the heat of Arizona kind of sparked a passion in you that, like I said, plays into what you're doing today about shaping stories.
Yeah, well, I'd love to hear the connection that you see between those because that's fascinating. I don't know that I've ever thought much about that. But yeah, I was born and raised in Phoenix. I've been in California since 2005, but a lot of my family's still there. And so I'm able to get back and forth. They come here, see the grandkids, of course. I've got three young kids. But yeah, Lisa, you've intrigued me. What's the connection between the heat and what I do now?
Well, okay. So you majored in journalism, I know, from Biola. Right. Uh-huh. Beautiful campus, by the way. Our middle daughter, when she was checking out universities, our son was in Studio City at the time, our older child. Yeah. He was in the movie industry for a while. And when our middle daughter was looking at university, she looked at Biola. She looked at Westmont and Santa Barbara, and she looked at Point Loma. If you know where Point Loma is,
I do.
She decided against Point Loma because, Will, the lecture halls overlooked, much like what Pepperdine overlooked the Pacific Ocean. And she goes, you know, I am too much, you know, scatterbrained. She goes, I know I would not be able to focus. So I cannot go here.
Yeah. But that's hilarious.
I know. But we even went to a... at Biola, I remember going to a general assembly with all the students. And, but anyway, beautiful, beautiful campus. But here is what I am supposing. The heat of Arizona maybe, you know, would cause you to be inside a little bit more than you would be otherwise. Right. And then, so you're having to figure out, okay, what am I going to do? And you probably, I would love to hear the story. I mean, when did you really start having this love for words and for storytelling, that would make you want to major in journalism?
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, and you're right. I mean, it is in the summers unbelievably hot, triple
Yes.
digits, of course, 115 some days. So I've never thought about that, but it's highly possible that, of course, when you're a kid, you go outside no matter what.
Yes.
You play in the little pool or the sprinklers, lots of super soaker battles, water gun fights back in the day. But yeah, my love for words, I think, really originated back in elementary school. And it was really my parents who helped draw that out of me in two ways. They read to me a ton. So both my parents were teachers, and I had to spend a lot of time in classrooms after everyone else had gone home from school. And of course, just books everywhere in those classrooms, all the 90s classics. I would just sit and read all those kids' books. And but when it came to writing, because I read so much and my parents read to me, I would write stories, and my parents would just cheer me on in that and celebrate that. This is kind of funny. I would even write poems to family members on their birthdays when I was like probably young elementary to mid elementary. And I entered some poetry contests and actually won, I think, in fifth or sixth grade. And so looking back, it feels silly. Like, what was this elementary kid doing writing stories? But actually, I think our passions and the trajectory of our lives is rooted in those early years. And so, because I have three kids of my own, knowing how much the adults in my life nourish those gifts, and if we're honest, nourished them before they were anything to write home about, but just saw a seed of potential and wanted to cultivate and nurture that. I'm looking for those things in my own kids. And my oldest is just 5, but already you can see patterns. You can see the little inclinations of my oldest daughter's heart and the types of activities she's drawn to. And those tastes and those passions will change with time, of course, or evolve. But that really is a part of my story. So, fast forwarding from there, I became a journalism major because really my main question walking into college was, how can I write? And I maybe thought a little about being an English major, but ultimately went the journalism route. And then, right as I was graduating, the recession of 2008 and 9 hit. And so, every newspaper, pretty much everywhere, had a hiring freeze. And here's the beautiful thing. I think I would have made a terrible reporter. That's just not me. That's not my lifestyle. Sort of always being on call, having to press people for information. I'm much more reflective and I'd say creative, although reporters are creative as well. But anyways, God pulled me into ministry for about 10 plus years. So I was a pastor and church planter here in Orange County. And kept writing that whole time. But there was just this point where, as a church planner, I needed supplemental income. So I was writing and editing on the side. And that just started snowballing. And I was getting more and more requests until finally a door opened up at Penguin Random House. And I'm now at Waterbrook and Multnomah, which is a Christian imprint. We actually just created a new division called Penguin Random House Christian. And so we publish mostly adult nonfiction and also do some kids' books. But I am thoroughly in the world of words and really passionate about the impact that writing can make. And who knew that in our digital age, books would still be something that they're not hanging on by a thread, they're doing quite well. Whether audiobooks, physical books that people are still reading. The industry is alive and well, and I think that too, when we have so many other options, speaks to the power of the written word and even the spoken word.
Well, you can probably tell behind me, I'm a lover of books too.
Yeah.
And in fact, what you don't see is I have a whole wall over on this side that is filled with books as well. And we've got books in boxes. Oh my goodness. I remember Will, my husband and I, we met in church when we were 3 and 5 and grew up together, went, dated through high school, dated through, he's a couple years older, dated through college. But, one of our date nights, would be like one of our favorite date nights was going to Borders or Barnes and
Oh,
Noble, into a
rip
bookstore.
Borders. It's
I
all
know
gone now, I
Borders,
think, right?
poor Borders. I know Barnes has stood the test of time. But there's just so much about what you've said that I really love. And I would love to do a study on this sometime, because I have read a lot about kids, and you kind of watch what they're drawn to. And sometimes, very oftentimes, it circles back to what they do later on. So like if a child is playing with Legos and building things, there's a good chance maybe that they're going to be in construction, or they'll be an architect or, you know, engineer. I do think it, those early experiences, to your point, really do play in. And I just love the fact that your parents were cognizant of your passions, right? And nurtured those. And I think it's just really important, because it probably gave you the confidence, Will, you know, if they hadn't have done that, you know, then maybe you would have questioned, but I think it probably gave you the confidence to keep going and exploring what God had for you in that. So there's a lot about what you said that I just love. My parents, it's funny, when I was 7 years old, they gave me a little blue typewriter. And I can remember, see, I'm a lot older than you are. You probably don't even remember what a typewriter is, Will.
We, believe it or not, we did we had one in my house.
You did?
I used to hammer away on that thing.
And I would just sit there and try to come up with stories, and, you know, and I love writing to this day. So I do think, you know, that those early things really do make a big difference. Well, now listen, you have had the opportunity to work with some authors, some of my favorite authors and projects. Jordan Rayner, I think you've done a little bit with Jordan. I love Jordan Rayner. I love Redeeming Your Time is one of my favorite books. Then he's written, and then he wrote the children's book, The Creator in You.
Yeah, such a good book.
Such a great book. For those listeners out there with littles, highly recommend getting that book, The Creator.
The Royal in You as well. That's
The Royal. See, I've not read that one.
Yeah, that one's a picture of heaven. Basically, it's the sacredness of secular work, which is his adult book. Translated for kids, and the illustrations, everything. We're doing like a promo for Jordan right now, because we're all big fans. But yeah, really excited to be partnering with Jordan, for sure.
That's awesome. And then you've had the opportunity, I'm not really sure what your role was there, Will, but you've had the opportunity to work on The Chosen, which is like one of our family's favorite series. Just incredible. What have you learned in working on The Chosen? What have you learned about biblical storytelling in a modern translation? Because it's, you know, they've taken a little bit of liberty, but, you know, I really have not, I've just artistically, I've not seen anything that is incongruent to this point.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great question. So, I was never, an official employee, but I was a contracted writer for them. And so the project I worked on, they wanted to roll out some curriculum for Gen Z, because when the show, when season one dropped, they had a demographic in mind who would watch it. And what they were surprised to learn is that actually Gen Z was really interested. Like, if you could get Gen Z to watch The Chosen, they were all in, like really, really captivated. And they actually created a documentary where they had, I think it was 8 or 10 Gen Z, you know, young adults watch the first season, and then they just recorded the whole experience. So anyways, what I did was they wanted to create a discussion curriculum for Gen Z based on the show. And so we would get assigned episodes of the show, and then we would write these discussion guides and questions that were intended to spark conversation about Jesus. And so one of my good friends does a lot of fundraising for the show, so I also have kind of a window there. But in terms of my experience, I think what I learned is, number one, that the film industry moves at an insane pace, and it is no joke. It's like a hurricane of activity. And even doing this one project with them, I got to experience that. But yeah, you know, I would say they're so intentional about everything they do. And so even the curriculum that I had the privilege of writing, we went through multiple rounds of edits and just kept asking again and again, is this clear? Have we removed all of the Christianese or the words that people newer to faith may not understand. And I think that discipline really captures what the show's trying to do. It's walking mm-hmm. such a fine line between wanting to be biblically accurate, cinematically captivating, welcoming to those who are outside the faith or curious about the faith. So it's like, that's a massive agenda. I think they do a really good job. In fact, there was an article I read recently where they were breaking down, here's all the things the creators of The Chosen have to balance. And I walked away with so much empathy because of course it has its critics, but sure. Overall, I think they do a really solid job.
Yes, I could not agree more. It is, and you use the word captivating, cinematically mm-hmm. captivating, and it certainly is that. So I just, 100%. We love it. We love it. And we kind of hang on, oh, when's the next episode coming out? So, well, let me ask you this. I mean, you see a lot of manuscripts and stuff, mm-hmm. you know, Will, in your work. I mean, what do you believe makes a manuscript go from good to great in your opinion?
What a great question. That's my job, actually, is to to try to champion an author's thoughts and ideas and words and really move them from good to great. I just had this conversation on my own podcast. It's called The Writer's Circle. But this literary agent was saying, you know, with the time allotted to create a book, like from the time that the manuscript is turned in to the time the book comes out, you can't take a mediocre manuscript and make it amazing. You can take a mediocre manuscript and make it good. Or if you receive a good manuscript, you can make it amazing. And I think that's really true. So that may be daunting to some listening, but so in other words, what I receive as a rough draft, I almost immediately know, okay, we're either talking, let's make this good, or let's really push because I think this has a shot at being great. And some of the things that go into that, so many. Off the top of my head, one is books that are written out of the deep overflow of what God's Spirit is doing in someone's life. There's a difference between writing about a topic and writing out of the deep well of your own experience. Mm-hmm. And maybe you're writing about suffering, for example. Maybe you're not actually in a season of deep suffering, but you've probably got to have tasted it, or maybe someone close to you, you're watching them go through it. And there's just something intangible that translates to the page when you are living what you are writing. So that would be one. Another would be timing. I think I've seen really good books go out into the world. I'd say great books go out into the world and they don't receive a huge reception. And sometimes it's like, oh, I thought for sure this one was going to hit bestseller list. And sometimes it's just a timing issue. I think God in his wisdom prepares audiences to be really receptive to certain books. And so there's just a moment in time where there's an urgency to the message of a book. A lot of people are feeling the ache that the book names. They need what the book is offering. And you can't manufacture that. That's what frustrates writers. As an editor, I get asked all the time, what makes a bestseller, or what does the market need right now, or what does this type of audience want? And I just say, I point them back to my first point, and I say, just don't worry. You can worry about that later, but when it comes to choosing your topic, take it before God, talk to those who really know you, and figure out what do you want to write about, and honestly talk about for the next 5 years, because that's what it's going to be for you
right.
once you write this book. So, and then there's the technical aspects of writing. Is this book structured well, or is it just sort of scattered thoughts on the page that now we're really going to have to do a lot of rearranging and organizing,
to make it like, feel well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The analogy I use that I borrowed from another editor is it's like pouring coffee. So a book that is unorganized, you might have the most delightful coffee, but if you just pour it out onto the table and it spills and it splashes everywhere, no one can actually enjoy it. It's just messy. what a structured book does, a good outline, a thoughtful outline, is it's basically like a mug. It's a container for your ideas. And once you pour that coffee into a mug, it's contained, it's drinkable, it's enjoyable. And so that's what a well-structured book does. It takes good ideas and it puts them in people's hands so that they can digest them and enjoy them. Rather than, you know, just kind of spraying them with all these ideas that you have. Right. And that's a great challenge. So that's a big part of what I do, is getting in there and finding the big ideas and asking, okay, what order can we present these? How can we tell a story with these ideas? And contrary to popular belief, an editor, in my case, I'm a developmental editor. My primary goal is not to worry about punctuation and grammar. If I see it, I'll fix it. But that's actually sure. what we call a copy editor.
Yes.
And they get into the real minute nitty gritty. What I do is more in the realm of ideas, shaping the structure of a book, working on introductions, hooks, things that draw in readers. And so anyways, that's a long answer to your question, but those are some of the things that I look for.
No, I love it. I love it. I love it. You know, because we may have some aspiring writers that are listening right now or have a book in them, you know, and those yeah. are great points. You know, the timing of the book and the release of the book mm-hmm. is so important. Tell me more, and you've already mentioned it, the writer circle. So I know yeah. there's a newsletter. I know there's a podcast. It really helps writers sharpen their skills. What inspired you, Will, to start this community? And do you have any memorable successes that you've seen from, you know, curating this community for aspiring writers and writers?
Yeah, absolutely. So in my day job as an editor, I mainly work with published authors who have sort of, they've built some kind of a platform. They've landed book deals. I do work with first-time authors as well, but the majority of them have already established themselves. Mm-hmm. And I love to teach. I think that's one of the things that God has called me to do. So not just to edit, but to help coach and train writers. And being an editor, you get a lot of emails and people asking, how does publishing work? You know, the very things we're talking about, what would make my book idea better? And I really have a heart to train writers who are just still figuring it out to sort of demystify publishing, to share, you know, whatever insider knowledge that I'm learning. And that's how I view it. I'm just sharing things as I'm learning them right. that may be helpful to them. And it's been a complete joy. I think it's called The Writer Circle. I have a podcast where I interview authors, literary agents, marketers. Basically, it's a Christian writer's dream. Like, here's all the stuff that you need to know, and not just industry knowledge, but here's how you nourish your soul. Here's how you root your identity in Jesus as you are pursuing your goals. Because writing is tough. Publishing is tough. Mm-hmm. It'll chew you up and spit you out. We need each other and we need encouragement. And I call it the writer's circle, sort of a double meaning. Publishing sometimes feels, to those who have not yet landed a book deal, like this elite inner circle that they're unwelcome to join until they do something cool or accomplish something. And I want to just erase that paradigm and instead say, no, by writer's circle, I mean, let's circle up just as humans and let's help one another. Let's encourage each other. Let's be generous with our knowledge so that those who really do want to put in the work and want to establish themselves as writers have handholds or stepping stones, and they can at least take their next step. And on their hard days, there's people around them to say, keep going.
Yes.
The Lord is with you. These words aren't wasted. Like, we need to hear those reminders. And even writers aside, I think we all just need that in the Christian life, as we pursue whatever it is God has put in our hands, whether it's raising kids or running companies mm-hmm. And everything in between, we need people around us. And so I'm trying to provide that community and that equipping for mm-hmm. writers.
Yeah, it's a beautiful ecosystem. And as you're talking, Will, I'm just thinking, you're putting all of the pieces together right? That there could be some amazing collaboration that even happens in that group when you've got literary agents and you've got the writers and you've got publishers and you've got all of these people in the ecosystem. Goodness gracious, I bet you there's some cool collaboration that's come out of that.
Definitely.
And I could not agree with you more. You don't have to be a writer. You can be a business owner. We all need people. I laughingly say I have those people in my life. I'm sure you do too. I hope you do. That are my Barnabases. You know, they are my Barnabases. They are my encouragers. And goodness, we need that, right? Just to have those people that go keep pressing on. You know, you're going to get there. Well, let me ask you this. You've said before in some of the things that I've researched that editing is like pastoral work. Can you expand on that? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. With any industry and certainly publishing, we compare ourselves to others all the time. I do it. I see a lot of writers doing it. It's the world that we live in. And so what I've discovered is that all the technical aspects of my job aside, right? Like I'm hired to make a book better. That is my job. But the real joy of what I do, and it includes that part of it, but is getting to walk beside authors and form friendships with them. And, you know, they're going through stuff, the ebbs and flows of life. They have disappointments, frustrations. And so just getting to be a constant presence. And at the particular publisher I work for, I'm actually with my authors from step A all the way to step Z. So from the moment we first start working on the book, through all of their marketing meetings, their pre-launch, you know, their launch phase, all the way until they release it. And then even afterwards, there's more work to be done, believe it or not. But I get to walk beside them. I love praying for my authors and with them. I do that quite often. And they don't just need someone with expertise. They need to be seen. They need encouragement. They need someone that's safe to process with. And, you know, publishing moves quick. And so there's a lot of, it's a team, a massive team that works on one book, but I get to be their point person. I get to be, like I said, their safe place.
I love that.
So because I was a pastor for so long, it's just in my DNA, honestly. I'm not preachy with them. I'm not always like, well, let's start this meeting in prayer, although there's nothing wrong with that. But it's really, I'm just listening and I'm trying to sense, okay, where is this author in life? And just last week, I had my very first meeting with an author, working with him for the first time. And he mentioned in the course of our conversation, that was really a professional conversation. We're working out, what is our editing schedule? How do you best work? How do I best work? But in the midst of that, he mentioned, this has been the most intense season of spiritual warfare I've ever experienced. And I just flagged that in the moment. And then at the end of the call, I said, hey, can I just pray for you? And, you know, it's nothing earth shattering. It's normal, you know, follower of Jesus stuff. But I think some folks would be surprised to know that even in Christian publishing, there's just so much to do. And the pace is so fast that stuff either can become perfunctory or just going through the motions. Like we just pray to start a meeting because that's what Christians should do, or it gets forgotten. And I think I've tried very imperfectly, mind you, I've tried to cultivate a sensitivity to God's spirit and just reading the room and knowing, hey, this may be a moment that I can bring my pastoral gifts to bear, or just my presence as a brother in Christ to these authors. And I will tell you, the reverse is also true. I've had authors texting me in the last few months asking about some medical things I was facing, saying, hey, how are you feeling? How's treatment going? And so I'm on the receiving end as well. I'm not the hero of the story. I'm just a brother in Christ who is, you know, doing hopefully good work with these writers. But yeah, I love that part of my job, the relational/pastoral element. Without it, I wouldn't enjoy what I do nearly as much.
Right. Well, it's what really gives it meaning. Will, yeah, and I'm thinking, you know, you're not their just their editor. You're doing life with them at that point. Mm-hmm. And that's just a beautiful thing. Well, we do need to take a quick break. And when we come back, Will, I want to get into just communication in general. Because there are, you know, there could be CEOs, CMOs, aspiring business leaders, all types of people. And I just feel like communication, honestly, is one of those skills. I don't care what your role is, what you're doing. We can all hone that skill and work on that skill to move the needle to become better communicators. So that's what I'd like to talk about when we come back. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Will Parker Anderson on the Something Extra podcast.
In business, the tendency is to seek out partners who are bigger, faster, stronger. When it comes to IT, you should be looking for smarter, faster, better. That's just what you'll find with the talented technologists at Technology Partners. Our experts develop custom solutions to tackle your most complex challenges, all to simplify your processes in the smartest, most efficient way possible. The time to be swift and nimble starts now. Go to technologypartners.net/solutions and see what's possible.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with Will Parker Anderson. So, Will, I've absolutely loved our conversation, but here I want to dig in deeper just to communication. It's just such an important topic. I don't care who you are. We always need to be looking, how can we improve this skill? Because it's so important. In fact, so many times, Will, even in teams and like dysfunctions with teams and things, if you really drill down to it, sometimes the root is miscommunication or thinking that you've communicated and all you've done is just said some words. But you know, communication is so much more than that, right? It truly is. Yeah. Like, how did the person on the other end receive that? Did they receive it? Did they understand what you were trying to communicate? And and if they didn't, then it's really the communicator's responsibility to go back and try to tweak that. But, you know, have you had a situation where you can look and see, what do you think one of the biggest mistakes that leaders and others can make in a communication?
Yeah, what a great question. And just so listeners know, I have a passion for writing and the words on the page, but I also love speaking and communication, and broke my heart, but I turned down an invitation to speak at a camp this summer, which is my absolute favorite thing to do. But with family commitments and everything else, just couldn't do it. But yeah, to me, being invited to do, you know, a week of talks where it's like we need 5 or 6 talks, I love that. I love getting into that, knowing that you have an opportunity to speak life to people. But to your question, there's lots of roadblocks. There's lots of landmines that we can unknowingly step on. So the first one that comes to mind is we overcomplicate, or we say too much. And simplicity in communication is everything, right? I went through seminary. I went through preaching classes where they really break down the theory of communication and what the experts say. Is that really max what the human brain can handle? And whether you're doing a 20-minute talk or an hour-long talk is about 3 big ideas. And the 3-point sermon is a famous formula that all those good Southern Baptist preachers like to employ. But anyways, limiting yourself to 3 ideas and learning the art of outlining. So maybe you do have 10 things you really want to say, and you're like, no, these are all essential. I don't want to lose any of them. I have this 1 30-minute slot and I want to maximize it. Well, that's great. How can you take those 10 if they absolutely can't go, which I would definitely press on a little, like, tell me more about these 10. This editor will help you eliminate some, but let's say you really do have 10 things you want to say. Well, how do you package them under 3 points? How do you fit them together and put them in mental compartments so that people can take those 10 ideas away with 3 souvenirs, like 3 big ideas? And there's a lot that could be said, but one of my favorite analogies, and it's attributed to different people, I apologize, I can't remember, but if you just picture a giant slab of marble, and if your task is to chisel out a statue, like the famous Statue of David, out of that block of marble, what we do as communicators is we think, ooh, the more I say, the better. The more I'm either going to prove my knowledge, or I maybe we have good intentions. I'm going to provide the most value I can, so I'm just going to pack this with information. That's the wrong question. How much can I keep? Master communicators ask the opposite question. How much can I eliminate? And so it's like you're carving out a statue from a block of marble. Your job is not done. You don't have that final statue until you have chiseled away absolutely everything that can go, until all that is left is your masterpiece or the core of your idea. And so I say simplicity. That's the principle. The actionable piece there is to become a ruthless eliminator and to really not hold back. And actually, it's like spring cleaning, the relief you feel as you're donating or giving away things that you don't need. You got to shed those ideas. And once a communicator learns to travel lightly and they see the impact that simplicity has on their audience, it becomes addictive. And pretty soon you're like, you feel this relief because you don't have to say it all. You don't feel less than, you don't feel like you need to impress. You're really focused on serving your audience. And that's what this is all about. It's not to say this in a confrontational way, but it's not about you. It's not about me.
Right.
As we are communicating, it is an act of love and an act of service. And I remember one of my first sermons. I had a friend who was really wise. And so I asked him, hey, what do you think of that message? And he gave me his honest thoughts. And I remember one of the things he said was, well, you were about 10, 12 minutes in, and I realized you were still in your intro. That was a bit long. And it was like, wow, I didn't even realize. And so maybe that segues into the next point, which is receiving feedback and not fearing it. I know so many communicators, and many of them are pastors, who have become so fossilized in their bad habits, week after week after week. And they make, it's a logical fallacy that the longer I've been doing this, the better I must be. There's a whole field of study around this called deliberate practice, which says, no, more reps does not guarantee improvement. What it guarantees is it's reinforcing what you're doing. But if what you're doing isn't correct, isn't useful, then you're just cementing bad habits. And that sounds harsh, but man, there is so much freedom and growth and welcoming feedback. Of course, I'm an editor. I'm going to be talking this way, right? But truly, here's the paradox that I've discovered. The communicators that I most look up to, who are have the most skill, the most charisma, honestly, the most favor over their speaking ability, they are the least offended or scared of feedback. They actually are more hungry for input, for people to tell them, tell me what I'm doing wrong. I just had an author I deeply respect and honestly look up to tell me last week, Will, I want you to make this the best that it can possibly be and hold nothing back. I think of athletes like Michael Jordan, who literally had a coach, a trainer for his diet, for different parts of his game, for his recovery, just all these experts around him. So the best actually know they need help the most. And it's our insecurity, our imposter syndrome that says, no, I got this. I've been doing this for a while. You know, I don't need help. And so I would just encourage people to ask the question, if you're a communicator, when was the last time you welcomed someone who you deeply respect, who has knowledge and wisdom, to just critique your communication and to help you find ways to improve? What you'll find is it increases your confidence You know, that initial sting is hard to hear. But on the other side of that, it's knowing some of your blind spots, and it becomes such a rewarding process.
Wow. That was just gold. Will, that was just gold. I mean, you just said blind spots. How do you identify? But you're blind to it. You have to have a mirror. You can't, right? Yeah. You got to have that mirror. And I always say that feedback is a gift. It truly, truly is. And so, but I think about, okay, what does it take though to receive the feedback? It takes humility.
Yeah.
It takes a willingness to be vulnerable, to say, hey, I realize I am not the smartest person in the room. And that often boils down to a pride thing, right? Mm. It really does. And pride, as we know, is very dangerous. There's just so much, goodness gracious, we could do a whole podcast. I could just keep asking you questions along this line. But
yeah, real quick too, because not all feedback is created equal, and some have maybe received unkind, untrue, or unhelpful feedback. And I totally get that. And so
yes,
I've been on the receiving end of some really harsh words that have echoed in my mind for years, even though I know it wasn't fair. So there's four, and this will be super quick, but there's four questions that I've thought through in evaluating feedback that helps you parse that out. And hopefully we all have someone readily in mind that can offer thoughtful, tactful, challenging feedback. But the four questions are, is it trustworthy? We have to lean on relationships. Mm-hmm. If you don't know a person at all giving feedback, got to be really careful how much you listen to.
Yes.
The second question is it specific? So rather than that was a bad talk, that's general and fuzzy and doesn't help you. Is it specific? In other words, like my friend, hey, your intro specifically was 10 minutes. It should have probably been 3 or 4 minutes with the time you had. The third question is it true? Sometimes the feedback that hurts the most or isn't super helpful still has a shred of truth. And so it's learning to parse out, okay, is this actually true? Or if it's partly true, what is the part that I can actually hold on to and then leave the rest behind me? And then number four, the last question, is it actionable? Is this feedback something that I can actually take and do something with? So going back to my example, absolutely. The next time I preached, you better believe my intro was...
It's
probably still like 6 or 7 minutes if I'm being real, mm-hmm. but it put it on my radar, and then I could actually do something with it because it was specific. So anyways, just wanted to throw that in there I see those people who have been burned before by harshness.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to your point, if you allow that in, without asking those questions and having that discernment, Will, that stuff can echo, right? And it can be damaging and limit you.
Yeah.
So that's really great. I have just a couple more questions, and then we're going to talk about something extra. You wrote a post that I read lately. I would really highly encourage our listeners, go follow Will. I mean, he's very active on LinkedIn. He's writing great posts. Connect with him. Because I think what he's putting out there is going to really help you. But you wrote a post that I read about engaging your kids in scripture over the summer. Mm. And it was really a powerful post. You're like, we can do all these things, but why not take this time to really get them ingratiated more into scripture? I think you've got 3 kids of your own. You already mentioned that. Callie, Hayden. Yeah. And what's the baby?
Our youngest is Adley.
Oh, I love that name, Adley.
Yeah.
Callie, Hayden, and Adley. Can you share an idea with them? How can they, what can they do if this is important to a listener?
Yeah, well, really, I mean, I love scripture, and it's been such a part of my life, even from an early age. I've always loved it. And I think part of that is because my parents found ways of just modeling what it looks like to love scripture. It was never a rote discipline, or it was never made to feel boring or like a chore. So My parents would often just share sort of off the cuff, like, oh, I was reading this verse and here's what this means to me. Here's how it's speaking to my life right now. And so I really want my kids to experience the same. And I think it can be intimidating for most of us as parents to think about how do we introduce our kids to this massive book that's hard for them to understand. Of course, there's wonderful children's Bibles and resources. But for me, one really simple thing is we have occasionally chosen memory verses for our kids, just verses we want them to learn. And we've found that teaching them through song is by far the best. So song and rhythm. And if you just YouTube it, you can find so many resources. You could put in the verse you're looking, unless it's real obscure, if you're in like Leviticus somewhere, maybe not, but you know, any of the biggies. Yeah. Like, for it is by grace you have been saved. Yes. Right. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. All the headliners. You can find multiple songs on all of them. And yes. So we'll just listen to those in the car on trips. For a while, and it's always changing with the seasons, but we would do every morning, we'd watch one of those songs. But I also remember I went on a daddy-daughter trip with my oldest. This was now two summers back. And I just got out my real Bible and I found the memory verse that she was learning through a song. And I pulled out a highlighter and it was really fun for her. We just highlighted it in the Bible. That was literally it. It probably took 10 seconds. And then I think we went and found a second and third verse that she had learned. And that is so rudimentary. It may sound boring on the surface, but she really enjoyed that little activity. It made her feel special. It was like her getting to do something in daddy's big Bible. And
right.
I think we put too much pressure on ourselves that somehow we have to be these master Bible teachers or have this robust curriculum. Honestly, even just putting your Bible on the kitchen table and mentioning it, something that simple is where it starts. Hey, do you know what this is? Oh, this is a Bible. Do you know what a Bible is? Well, this is a book that God wrote to us. This is daddy's favorite book. For them to see you opening it, holding it. And part of that may be, you know, putting your smartphone down. They're going to figure out there's Bible apps eventually. They're going to run circles around us technologically.
Yes.
But yeah, just having a physical Bible around, I think, is a huge win for little kids, especially. And then, of course, as they get older, you can start to actually do real studies for them. And I've done that a lot with others in my life. As my kids get older, I'm really excited to start doing that with them.
Do the same thing with them.
Conversations.
Yeah, that's so good. Will, I've talked to so many people that'll say, you know, that my grandma's Bible, you know, was always on their coffee table. I mean, there is really something to that. And I will attest, I mean, I learned some Bible verses, as a young woman, you know, a young person that I still remember. And I learned the Gettysburg Address through song. So there is definitely a connection there. There definitely is. So I love that you brought that up, that parents can Google that and find these amazing verses that someone has put to song. I got a little lightning round for you. I know you're love a fan it. Of Mexican food and Rich Mullins. You know, what would your dream party look like? Okay, knowing that you love Mexican food and Rich Mullins, it's going to include some sort of, you know, good singing and tacos or something, right?
Yeah, dream party definitely would always include Mexican food. I would add of all varieties. Like Arizona is an interesting scene for Mexican food. It's got some like Tex-Mex vibes to it, but then a little bit more authentic Mexican as well. And then of course here in California, Tex-Mex is anathema. We're a little too healthy here on the coast. So
yes.
It's a lot more authentic Mexican food. Obviously, mm-hmm. we're really close to Mexico, and it's a wonderful part of our culture here. So, but yeah, a great party for me. There's got to be music for sure.
Yeah.
If it can be live music, that's probably the dream. For my 30th, a number of years ago, my wife had a songwriter friend of ours come and play a live set. And we have done a lot of worship nights or just almost open mic nights in our backyard. I have all the speakers, the mics, the sound system. I'm a musician. So we love anything that involves live music, not just like a Spotify playlist.
Right. Oh, I love that. I love that. Did I dream this or did I read this? Are you a drummer?
I am a drummer.
Yes. Okay. So see, it was in there somewhere.
It's impressive. Yes.
Okay, good. That's awesome. Well, I grew up with music too. Music has always been a very big part of my life since I was like 4 years old. I started singing solos in our church and just, I love music. It's the universal language, is it not?
Yeah.
It really is.
Absolutely. I mean,
it can move your soul like nothing else, but
yeah.
Let me ask you this. You've got a saying too. Here's a Willism. You said that you run on caffeine and grace. So what's your go-to?
Yeah, well, this is a curveball because I actually am a huge tea drinker, which people, it confounds them. They're like, what are you drinking? I get made fun of a lot for it if I'm being real, but
yes.
I stick to my guns. I do like coffee. If I'm going to drink coffee, the reason I don't drink a lot of it is it wires me in a way that I can't sleep and I'm getting a little older, Lisa. So, you know, coming up on 40 here and it just wires me. So, but yeah, I drink a lot of black and green teas is my mm-hmm. go-to daily drink. And that gotcha. Gives me, I drink it all day. So I don't know if that's good for me or not.
I think it is. It's supposed to be good for you. I'll ask our nutritionist and I'll let you know. Okay.
Please do.
Okay, I have one last question to ask you before we talk about something extra, because I know that this is a question that you ask your guest.
Oh no.
I know. See, I turned the tables on you here. Okay, yeah. So if life was a book, what would the title be?
Oh no. You got me. Oh, wow. Yeah, I had an author who I was interviewing flip it on me, and I was like, no. This is your interview. You can't do this. I've interviewed dozens of people. I don't know that I've thought about it, but I'll come up with an answer for you.
Okay.
Man, this is so hard. I'm experiencing in real time what I do to the authors that I
interview. What you do to your guest?
I've started giving them a heads up because that's only fair.
I can't believe I could come up with something better. Will. I can't believe
you stumped the editor. Well, I know how much goes into the titling process, and so I feel that pressure. But what I think about right off the bat, and something that I often carry with me, is a gratitude for the patience of God. Like when I think through the seasons of my life, I just think, wow, I was either so foolish or so clueless in that season, and yet God was the same there as he is now. And I'm probably still foolish, stumbling around in so many areas that I don't even recognize.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just, we talk about God's patience, but the depth of his patience has always gripped me. I can't believe for my whole life he has been present. So my title would be something about that.
I like it. Grateful
for the patience of God.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, steadfast
love of God. Long-suffering with us. My goodness, how many times we mess up, you know, and to your point, he continues to pursue us. He's patient. He's like, I meet you where you are. You know, it's just, that's so good. I love it. Well, let me ask you this, because this is the question I ask every one of my guests. What is the something extra you believe every leader needs?
That's a fantastic question. The something extra that every leader needs. You know, I would probably say to rest in the grace of God, but really to know that you're not going to get it right and that you don't have to create a false narrative that spins what you do into, you know, perfectionism. But you can actually really lean heavily on the grace of God to cover those mistakes, the times you didn't know what to do or did the wrong thing. And actually, I had someone say to me once, lead out of your weakness. Don't hide it, but put it in the forefront. And that's not to say you overshare or you're just emotionally leaking on those that you lead, or over divulging. But what it means is you are vulnerable and humble, and you're willing to show your need for grace and the confidence you have in that grace of God more than in yourself. And here's the thing, people will exploit that at times, and they will be unfair and hurtful and say things like, oh, well, I knew that you were always dot, dot, dot. But for the majority of folks that you're leading, that's going to give them freedom to be real and to know that you are a safe place. And yeah, so
it's beautiful.
Lean on grace and lead out of weakness.
Ooh, now there's a book title for you.
There it is. There it is. You're welcome to use that one.
There is a book title for you, Will. Well, hey, listen, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for agreeing to come onto the show. And I just know that everything we've shared here, I mean, I know it's going to help our listeners. I encourage our listeners to reach out to Will and, you know, follow him. And I just know that I've learned a lot today and I've been inspired. So thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, of course, Lisa. It's great to be with you.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.